First Chronicles chapter 6, we are continuing the chronicler's introduction to really the life of David in First Chronicles, and so our theme is King David. We have selected verses that we'll take once again, and hopefully that will be interesting. A lot of thought and research went into producing this document, this chronicle, this history of the Jews. And remember, he's writing to those Jews who were once in captivity. They're now back in their land, rebuilding their temple, reinstituting worship, and he is looking to stir them, to motivate them, to inspire them back to the beauty of their faith. And there are quite a few obscure verses. We will pass over most of them. They're very interesting to dig into, but in the end, it's not definitive, not enough information. But more heroes, more gallantry will come from the pages as he begins now in this sixth chapter. This sixth chapter, the subject is the priestly tribe, and he'll hit many of them as he's going through. Judah is the kingly tribe. Judah gets the most attention. The Levites get the second most attention, and it is devoted to centering on David again, and so we'll be repeating that as we go through, and we'll find out why. Why was the author, the chronicler, so occupied with David? Well, it's going to happen once we get into begin with chapter 11. It will shine out on its own. The people that were attracted to him and why they were, this spiritually charismatic individual. Would to God we could all be like David in that light. And so, verse 1, the sons of Levi were Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. Levi, again, he is the patriarch. These are his sons, and from him come this Levitical line, and from the Kohathites comes the priestly line. And anyone who wanted to serve in the temple had to establish their Levitical line that they were related to Levi. And if you wanted to serve as a priest, you had to establish that you were related to Kohath through Aaron. And this is why they kept the list of names. We come across them in the New Testament. Each tribe would keep their record. And this verse 2, the sons of Kohath, then verse 3, the children of Amram, that would be the father of Aaron, Moses, and Miriam. And the sons of Aaron were Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. And this is what is forming the priesthood. Most of us, or all of us, on a Wednesday night should be familiar with all these names, Abraham, Moses, and Miriam. But not so much Eleazar and many of the others that are listed here. Now, in the days of David, the priestly service was divided up in two between Eleazar and Ithamar. You see, David, his influence as king, he knew he had the authority spiritually and as king, and he exercised it to the glory of God, to Yahweh. He was very careful, very deliberate, and very successful at doing this. He took the reins. God made me king. And he made me king to bring glory to him. And so Eleazar, his line, they served two-thirds of the time. And then Ithamar, they served the other third because of the difference in the numbers. There were more from Eleazar than the other, Ithamar. Verse 4, Eleazar begot Phinehas, and Phinehas begot Abishua. Now, Eleazar, as we'll look down to verse 15, you see the name Jehozadak. Jehozadak was the last priest of Judah before the captivity. 22 priests in an unbroken line from Eleazar to Jehozadak. And so there was much success. Phinehas, of course, is the hero of Baal Peor. We've been touching on his name quite a bit from the time of Malachi and now into Chronicles. He was the one that stood up against the mingling of the faith, though the race, which was the faith, of course. And had he not stood up, God's wrath would have been, we could only imagine, unleashed to who knows what end. In verse 10, Johanan begot Azariah. It was he who ministered as priest in the temple that Solomon built in Jerusalem. So here again, he takes this opportunity, the chronicler does. He says, here's a hero. Here's a hero of our faith. He ministered at the temple that, of course, was gone. Solomon's temple had long been gone, over 70 years and perhaps and more at the time that this was finally put together. But he stops. He makes these stops throughout the introduction, these first nine chapters, to point these things out to inspire the people. Verse 15, Jehozadak went into captivity. When the Lord carried Judah and Jerusalem into captivity by the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, here is shame, the distinction of shame. It was honor for the priest that was the first one, to the high priest of the tabernacle that Solomon was privileged to build. And here, the shame that belonged to Jehozadak at the destruction of that temple. His son was Joshua, who we read about in Zechariah chapter 3. He was part of the priest that had come back to Jerusalem with Zerubbabel. Remember, Zechariah and many of the other priests were just excited about going back to Jerusalem to reinstitute worship. And he was a righteous man. And it was to him that in the vision Zechariah saw, God said, take off the filthy garments and put a mitre on him. And he garbed him in the priest of the representative of Yahweh Almighty. As we are to be garbed as Christians, we are to have the outfit, the gear necessary to function as a royal priesthood. We serve a king who is God the Son. And we are to be fitted to do this, and it's going to take work. Well, verse 28 now, the sons of Samuel were Joel the firstborn and Abijah the second. Oh, this is getting good. This is good. Already we've had one flop and a recovery. Jehozadak, then his son Joshua. And now we have Samuel, one of his no-good sons. He had two of them we know of, and they both were rotten. 1 Samuel 8. In fact, it was these two sons of Samuel that precipitated the monarchy. The people were just used it as, you know, we're done with judges and right godly men. We want a king like all the other nations. And when that began, of course, with Saul. But here is an account of the sons of Samuel. The name of the firstborn was Joel. The name of his second, Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba, but his sons did not walk in the ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, perverted justice. Rotten, no good scoundrels. That part is added, of course. Now, hold that thought for a moment. We're going to come back to it in just after considering a couple of more verses, and we'll return to that thought. In verse 31 we look at now. Now there are the men whom David appointed over, these are the men David appointed over the service of song in the house of the Lord after the ark came to rest. And so you see, David is jazzed about worshiping the Lord. He has got the energy and the desire and the authority, and he has the people. Verse 32, they were ministering with music before the dwelling place of the tabernacle of meeting until Solomon had built the house of Yahweh in Jerusalem, and they served in their office according to their order. So the temple musicians were Levites, and they were, their role was laid out for them by David, but first by Samuel. And we'll come to that later, but I won't forget because we'll come to the verse, but just exciting. They were divided into three groups according to their descent of Levi's three sons. Now, verse 33, I said we would hold that thought from verse 28 about Samuel's no good sons. We read verse 33, 1 Chronicles 6. And these are the sons who ministered with their sons. Of the sons of the Kohathites were Heman, the singer, the son of Joel, the son of Samuel. And there it is. You could say He-Man. It's probably more closely pronounced He-Mon, but He-Man is how we're going to do it. And he is the grandson of Samuel. Samuel had a He-Man for a grandson. And he was a he-man in the faith also. And that's what's so exciting. The deadbeat son in Joel, but he recovers with his grandson. This man is a big part of worship during the days of David. He is the center of their worship with song, and especially with song. It will be Asaph, Ethan, and He-Man in the middle, but he is the centerpiece, and we're going to be told that shortly. And so, again, here Samuel's grandson is the champion of the faith in David's day. Verse 39 now, and his brother Asaph, who stood at his right hand, was Asaph, the son of Berechiah. Now, this is interesting. He says Asaph, his brother, but he's not his biological brother. That's why he points out a different father, the son of Berechiah. So what he is saying is these men were brothers in the faith. They had the same cause, the same craft, and the same country. And you follow that alliteration, the cause, the craft, and the country. They were singers. They belonged to Israel. And their cause was to worship the Lord. And that united them. And so the chronicler says his brother Asaph. And he's worth talking about a little bit, because we're told that he sounded cymbals before the Ark of the Covenant when it was moved from the house of Obed-Edom to Jerusalem. Cymbals, you say, that's really not an impressive. Can you do better? What do you have before the Ark of the Covenant? I'm just playing with the words. I'm not accusing anybody of anything. But you imagine, there he is. Even though the cymbals may not be the most intricate of instruments, it is one of the most noticeable. When you see them with cymbals, you notice, what are they doing? I could do that. Well, anyway, there he was, ministering before the ark. We'll get to that in the 16th chapter. And his family became one of three given this responsibility of music and of song in the temple, as I mentioned. After the captivity, which is the time that Chronicles was written, incidentally, 128 singers, that's a big choir, from this family alone came from Babylon. Ezra chapter 2, verse 41, the singers, the sons of Asaph, 128. The influence, the ability to pass it on, and that's fruit. Fruit means you are continuing the life. And it is something that should energize us. This is why I'm so excited to do Chronicles. I've been reading it in preparation for it months ago. I can't wait for this for my own sake. My own walk with the Lord. And so they were part of that choir at the laying of the foundation of Zerubbabel. And back to Haman now, or He-Man, the grandson of Samuel. He stood in the middle, we are told. That is the most honorable position, with Asaph on his right hand. And so we look at again, verse 39, and his brother Asaph, who stood at his right hand. That, of course, the antecedent is He-Man, and he is the one that is in the center. Ethan will be on the other side. Now, a little bit more about this grandson of Samuel. He penned the saddest psalm of them all, the 88th psalm. He is also the one that cried out to God in the midst of this devastating psalm. Sort of like the Lord on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Still calling out to God, still praying, still knowing where to direct his spirit in the midst of horrific circumstances. We read Psalm 81, verse 1, a psalm of the sons of Korah to the chief musician. Now, the sons of Korah, that any of them survived is a miraculous act of mercy on God's part, but it continues, a contemplation of He-Man the Ezraite. That's a line of priest. O Lord, God of my salvation, I have cried out day and night before you. He is the psalmist that cried out in the midst of a despondent psalm. It is the lowest point, of the spiritual man, that 88th Psalm. Now, Ethan, we'll get to him in verse 42. He is on his left, as I mentioned, and we'll meet him in the Psalms also. Asaph, Heman, and Ethan, all contributors to what we call our Holy Bible. And these three are celebrated for their skill in singing. They're skilled. I attended a church at when I first became a Christian, and there was one particular person who was very unskilled, and I thought it was criminal to unleash that person on the congregation. Nobody wanted to tell them, you know, you can't. Maybe after a while they finally could. But anyhow, the continuing on with this, verse 42, the son Ethan, the son of Ethan. Well, Ethan's the name I just want to pull out of that. And he has an alternate name, Jeduthun, and we'll meet him later in Chronicles also. And so the Kohathites were led by Heman, the Gershonites by Asaph, and the Merariahites by Ethan. Each line of the priestly, of the Levitical order, was covered by one of these Levites. Verse 48, and their brethren, the Levites, were appointed to every kind of service, the tabernacle of the tabernacle of the house of God. But verse 49 now, but Aaron and his sons offered sacrifices on the altar of burnt offerings, on the altar of incense, for all the work of the most holy place, and to make atonement for Israel according to all that Moses, the servant of God, had commanded. The Levites could assist in ministry and all sorts of ministry. They assisted the priests. They were both, the priest and the Levites were both from Levi, but the priests were extracted out of that line of Kohath. And the Levites could not offer the incense on the golden altar. They could not mix the spices to make up the incense. There were many things that they were prohibited from doing. Only the line of Aaron could do certain things. And we never hear a peep from them complaining. We never hear them say, why can't we be priests and wear those, you know, nice hats and have that evil? Why can't we? Never. This is what God has assigned us to. It is remarkable. It is a quest of all Christians to live in contentment. It's very difficult to be content. Verse 54, now these are the dwelling places throughout their settlements in their territory, for they were given by lot to the sons of Aaron of the family of the Kohathites. Now he's going to list the Levites to verse 64. We're going to skip much of that. But they get Hebron, verse 55. They gave them Hebron in the land of Judah with its surrounding common lands. But the fields of the city and the villages they gave to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, that is Caleb, who was the friend of Joshua, one of the two spies that had faith. Verse 57, and the sons of Aaron, they gave to the cities, they gave one of the cities of refuge, Hebron, with its common lands. Well, should pause here for a moment to talk a little bit about this. The priests were to oversee the judicial processes in an accidental murder. And so these cities of refuge were established, three on the east side of Jordan, three on the west side of Jordan. And if you accidentally killed someone, you could flee to one of these cities and be safe there until your trial. And if you were found innocent, you would stay in that city until that high priest, whoever was high priest at the time, died. And then you could return to your land. You could go anytime you wanted to, but if you did, if you went outside of the parameters set in the law, then the family member the one you killed by accident, if they wanted to take vengeance on you, they could. And they would not be charged with a crime. We look at that and say, this is kind of wacky, but it is, you know, those times were different. People thought differently, behaved differently, and this is how God put a border around it. And also, I would add, it is an indication of God's understanding of our emotions. He's not blessing them. He's trying to corral them. And they would get these common lands. They got Hebron. Caleb got Hebron. That was really in his territory. But they were assigned this Levitical city of refuge. And they could farm right around up to that little land. About a 1,500-foot circumference was theirs. They did not live off of this land. It was clear that they were to live off of the offerings at the temple from all the tribes. But this was a bonus that was given to them. Caleb had more land than he needed, and it was probably an honor to Caleb to have a city of refuge, to have priests within his territory. And so, again, because the priests did not receive any territory as Levites, but they did receive land for themselves, of course, and he lived amongst the people in that way. Verse 67, and they gave them one of the cities of refuge, Shechem, with its common lands in the mountains of Ephraim. The common lands, again, that 1,500-foot thereabout, the circumference around the city itself. So they'd get the city, it'd be a walled city, they'd have houses, they'd live there, and then they had some space to do farming and raise cattle and whatever else livestock they wanted to do. And then they would go off to Jerusalem in rotation and receive their wages from the offerings of the people. There were 48 Levitical cities, which not all of them were cities of refuge, as I mentioned. Verse 67 now, Shechem is mentioned. Shechem is a big city to the Jew. Its history is loaded. Shechem was where Abraham put his first altar to the Lord. That alone would elevate the city in the minds of the Jews. Of course, the vendetta of Simeon and Levi took place, and that was a shameful act. Joshua built an altar there, had the people recite from Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal the curses and the blessings of Yahweh. Rehoboam, that foolish king, was crowned there in Shechem. And that's just about five of the things that had gone on in this city. There are more. Now we go to 1 Chronicles 7, and we get six tribes mentioned here. Issachar, Benjamin, Naphtali, Manasseh, Ephraim, and Asher. Missing are Zebulun and Dan. Don't know why, but they're not numbered. As I mentioned, there's some obscure verses, just don't have enough information. But it seems as though the six tribes mentioned are directly associated with Judah moving towards, again, David. That's the goal of the author, to get us to David, centering it on him. And we're just going to go along with him. Now, verse 13 of chapter 7, the sons of Naphtali, they're just dismissed. There's really nothing it says about them. And they were greatly reduced in size and importance. You can read this in 2 Kings chapter 15, by the Assyrian raiders that would come into the land and just picking off Zebulun until they were just relatively insignificant. Now, verse 15, this is a juicy verse worth memorizing. We'll just take the names, Huppim and Shuppim. That's their names. I just couldn't pass that by. It deserves an honorable mention for being difficult to mention. Verse 20, the sons of Ephraim. Now, verse 21, the men of Gath who were born in that land killed them because they came to take away their cattle. Verse 22, then Ephraim, their father, mourned many days, and his brethren came to comfort him. This is a difficult verse in that, did it take place? Is this the patriarch Ephraim, the son of Joseph himself, while he was still in Egypt? Does this mean the Jews maintained trade and activity and pastoring flocks in Gath, in Canaan? Or is this another man by the name of Ephraim and the writer expected his audience to know? It does seem like this is Ephraim in Egypt. And his sons went into Gath, where along the west coast there of Israel, and where the Philistines had great territory. Goliath was from Gath, for example. Plundering of flocks was common in those days. If you could get away with it, do it. It was almost expected of you to do these things amongst many peoples. One of the tricky things is in verse 21, it says the men of Gath who were born in the land killed them because. Well, some Hebrew scholars say, well, the word could be when and not because. I read that and I go, yay, can't you guys figure it out? It's not enough, because that changes the meaning. Did the sons of Ephraim go to rustle the cattle, or did the Gathites go to rustle? And it's a little confusing, obscure. So just a quick overview. Well, the sons were killed, and Ephraim mourned, verse 22. The conflict with Gath, the mourning of the son, the story concludes with another child born and someone naming him the wrong way. So we leave verses 20 through 22, obscure as they are, satisfied that the original audience understood it. God knows what's going on. We have fragments, and they're not worthless. They in your devotion time, they're worth pondering. I mean, this was a tragedy. It was a great loss to this man, Ephraim. But verse 23, and when he went into his wife, she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Beriah, because tragedy had come upon his house. Dramatically memorializing the tragedy by pinning an unfortunate name on the lad. This irks me. Well, it was the custom. It was a bad custom. As parents who thought it permissible to stick an innocent child with a guilty name or a name that's just associated with a disaster. Imagine naming your kid 9/11 or Pearl Harbor. I mean, who would want to do such a thing? It's almost vindictive. So let's review a couple of these. Rachel, when she was dying, giving birth and dying, Ben Onhai, son of sorrows. Thank God. Jacob was there to overrule it. Son of my right hand, Benjamin. Then there's Ichabod. It means inglorious. Well, the glory has departed. No glory here. It's gone. It was once here. We lost it. Let's name the kid that. He was the grandson of Eli, and his two brothers, Hophni and Phinehas, were just as crooked as Samuel's two sons, Joel and Abijah. And of course, the Philistines ended up getting the ark. You know, they took the ark before them into battle. They didn't care about the Lord. They just, you know, it was our team versus them, big gang fight. And they were killed on the battlefield, and they lost the ark. And the mother gives birth, and she says, name him Ichabod. And what gives her the right? Our parents don't own their kids. They're entrusted to us. And then there's Jabez. We discussed him last section in chapter 4. Let's name him train wreck or shipwreck. Let's name him, you know, funeral parlor. Then Beriah here. His name means calamity. Calamity Beriah. Again, nothing to do with these events, but let's pin this on the kid so we can remember this every time we see him coming. And I think it's, you know, they think they're permitted to mark these children with these distasteful names for life. And they have so many other heroes they could have named them. Anyway, that's my disappointment. And you know what? There's still people that are like this today, but they don't come out to a midweek Bible study. They might hear something that would correct them on something else. Anyway, verse 40 of chapter 7. Only one part stands out. Choice men, mighty men of valor, chief leaders. These were the children of Asher. And it is said to, again, inspire the present generation. And it should inspire us when we read this. You know, choice men and women, mighty in valor, chief leaders. Now, Chronicles 8, the first verse introduces Benjamin. Now, Benjamin. Now, this is the line of King Saul, and that's where the chronicler is working it through the histories, getting to King Saul, Israel's first king, so that he can tell us what happened to him, and then introduced David, who, by contrast, is remarkably wonderful over, over Saul. For most people, there were a few people that did not see it that way. And we won't get so much of that in the Chronicles. That most of it is in Samuel's account of David's life. Well, Saul, he was David's relentless foe. There are those people in life that just, you know, you just can't get away from easily. They stick with you for decades. And I forget the names, politicians in England that had a rivalry almost all their lives. They hated each other. And Disraeli and, I forgot. Anyway, I should have wrote it down. We'll come back to this. Jonathan was Saul's son and his closest friend, David's closest friend. And David was Jonathan's closest friend. And the love that they had for each other did compensate some degree for the cruelty that David had to endure from Saul, the viciousness. A lily among thorns. Verse 6. These are the sons of Ehud, we remember him as the judge, who were in the heads of their father's houses of the inhabitants of Geber, who were forced, who forced them to move to Manahath. The writer here, I think, is exposing government forced relocation. He's saying this is not how we do it. And I think that's why he inserts this here. They may have thought it was a good idea at the time when they forced this on their people to relocate, but he puts it in here as though to say, this is the promised land. Who do these people think they are? And this would have been very helpful at the time of rebuilding the nation. Verse 13, we have a mention here of Beriah and Shema. They drove out the inhabitants of Gath. And so there's gallantry. He, as often as he can, he seems to bring that up. Verse 33, Kish begot Saul. Saul begot Jonathan. The other two sons are listed here. Malchishua and Abinadab and Eshbaal. Another critical point. Why Eshbaal means man of Baal. Ishbaal. Baal is a pagan god. Why would the king of Israel allow any of his sons, this being the youngest, to be named after a pagan god? Well, it's typical of Saul. He was very shallow. The 10th chapter ends with commentary on that very thing. And so here he is. His name is mocked in 2 Samuel, Ishbosheth, and that means man of shame. And I think it's intentional, as we've covered through some of the writers. When they had a chance to launch a zinger, they did, and that is one of them. But we see that it penetrated the king's court, his own family. He has this religious syncretism, this mixing it up of, you know, a little bit of Yahweh, a little bit of Baal. It's terrible, but it's a big indication of what's going on. The Jews reading this would have picked up on that. They wouldn't need somebody to go get a commentary, look up in a concordance or something what that name means. They would have got it right away. Well, verse 34, the son of Jonathan was Meribbaal. This is Mephibosheth, and instead of it's a man against Baal. There's some debate on that name. Some suggest that, well, it crept into Jonathan's house too, but it seems like, no, maybe not. Maybe it was actually a counter name, a name to counter this cause of Baal. Either way, it is altered. Now we come to the 9th chapter. And these are the genealogies up to the generation that's now that this document was written for. So they're reading about their times now. The dwellers in Jerusalem who returned from the captivity, the heads of the families of Judah and Benjamin and the priests, the Levites. Verse 1, so all Israel was recorded by genealogies, and indeed they were inscribed in the book of the kings of Israel, but Judah was carried away captive to Babylon because of their unfaithfulness. Now, the book of Kings here is not the books of Kings we have. There are no genealogies in there. This is another record, scribal record, that belonged to the court of the kings, and he refers it loosely here as the book of the kings, but it's not the same one. Well, I mean, nothing surprising. There are many, many books, libraries, just as we do today, but of course, most of it has been lost. But it is a pointed reminder of the consequence of apostasy when he says, Judah, the tribe of praise, the great lion of Judah, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, went into captivity because of unfaithfulness. Apostasy. It can happen to anybody. The strongest, the biggest, the greatest can crumble. Verse 2 of Chronicles 9, and the first inhabitants who dwelt in their possessions in their cities were Israelites, priests, Levites, and the Nethinim. Well, here they're coming back to the land, and the Nethinim, it's a fun name to say. For most words with the tongue, the TH, the tongue coming off the teeth, the, that, this, Nethinim. It's fun to say. Anyway, the word is derived from the Hebrew to give. And they were people given to the Levites and the priests to help with menial tasks at the temple. And there would be much to do there. It is not clear whether they were all Jewish or not. Ethnically, were they Jews or were they not? You remember the Gibeonites deceived Joshua. And Joshua, when he found out, well, we can't kill you now because we entered a contract. But what we can do is make you servants, and you will haul water and chop wood for the temple. And that way, they were Nethinim. And the strong evidence indicates that they were not all Jews. And so the name doesn't show up before the books of captivity or after the captivity, Ezra, Nehemiah, 2 Chronicles. But there it is. And so just to point that out, they were, you could say, slaves of the temple for the Jews. Not slaves in a sense that somebody was over them with a whip, lashing them, driving them, feeding them gruel, and then chaining them up at night. Not in that sense, but that was what their station was in life, caste, if you will. Now, verse 10 of the priests, verse 13, and their brethren, heads of their father's houses, they were very able men for the work of the service of the house of God. You see, now there's another gallant mention. Here are able, eager servants for God's house, not lethargic, not wishy-washy, untrustworthy. These are very noble men. Not noble men in the sense of land barons, but noble in the sense of their high caliber of character and devotion to their work. Now, see, where we're going with this for the church is as we're watching these Levites and priests serve, what we're looking at is a template for the church. When Paul, who is largely the human architect of our modern church service, where did Paul get the template from? He got it from the synagogues, and he brought it into Christianity, and he filtered out those things that didn't belong because they had been fulfilled in Christ, and he retained those things that had to do with the assembly of human beings and worship and education in the faith. And with that, that brought a necessity for ushers, gatekeepers here. And so we're going to learn a lot about how business is to be conducted in God's house. Not to the exact, because it's still the law of the Jew, but certainly, though there are a great many redeemable features about this that we employ to this day to our benefit. And so, verse 14 of the Levites, verse 17, and the gatekeepers, verse 19, their fathers had been keepers of the entrance to the camp of the Lord. Just the language is superlative, is poetic. The camp of the Lord. It's a moving force. God's house on earth needs gatekeepers on multiple levels. We need ushers at the door who look out for the flock, who just by their presence deter those that would come and take advantage of us, those that would steal purses and pocketbooks or do other things. We have them strategically placed in the building whenever we assemble to look out for the flock. They are our gatekeepers. I come into the pulpit, I never have to worry about what's going on out there. I know that those men of God are assigned by God to what they do. They do it. They do it well. And you couldn't put an ad in the paper and get those men. You just couldn't. You couldn't mail away for them on, you know, Fetch and Usher website. You just couldn't. God has to bring them here. And the verse that belongs to them is out of the Chronicles. Well, here in verse 9, it was from family to family. And what the chronicler is attempting to, again, establish or restore is the uprightness of worship. This is just the beginning of it. Appropriately, the gatekeepers at the beginning. Much of it had been lost in captivity. Verse 20, and Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, had been the officer over them in time past. Yahweh was with him. That's what it says, and that's why I preserved that verse, selected that verse, just that phrase, Yahweh was with him. We all want that said about us. Verse 21, the keeper of the door of the tabernacle of meeting, verse 22, all those chosen as gatekeepers were 212. They were recorded by their genealogy in their villages. David and Samuel, the seer, had appointed them to their trusted office. This is magnificent. This is the genealogy. That's how we know, or Jesus knew, he was from the line of David and Bethlehem and Joseph and going all the way back and then from Mary's line, because their villages kept records. And here is evidence of that. Appointed by David. But what's Samuel's name doing there? He died long before the temple was planned. David's the architect of the temple. God gave him the plans. He couldn't build it, but he wrote it down and he gave it to Solomon. And he never got to see it in this world. Well, Samuel and David got before long ago, and Samuel said, David, this is how you do it. This is how worship, the day is going to come where you're going to be king. God sent me, I anointed you. I didn't like it at the time, but I did. But you're going to be king, and you're going to build the temple. And this is how you should set it up. And David is going, yep, and writing it down, every bit of it. And so it's passed on. The chronicler, he marks it down for us that David was instructed by the prophet Samuel from his youth. And so in that sense, Samuel appointed the gatekeepers through David. He gets his credit. He was a spiritual influence. Again, when we do the life of Samuel, he is one of the most magnificent characters in all the scriptures. He's right up there with Daniel, and none higher among men. Verse 23, so they and their children were in charge of the gates of the house of God, the house of Yahweh, the house of the tabernacle, by assignment. He's saying this is our heritage. This is what we have now. David set this up, and we... You know, fathers raise up our sons to enter into the various ministries that we serve in. And if they say, well, Dad, I don't want to work as an usher, but I'd like to work in the children's ministry. Well, okay, that's nothing wrong with that. Or if he follows his dad and says, you're an usher, I'm an usher. The gatekeepers, verse 24, were assigned to the four directions, east, west, north, and south. Full, total, absolute coverage. Verse 25, and their brethren in their villages had to come with them from time to time for 7 days. And so the rotation, not to burn them out. We work hard for that here. We want you in the sanctuary. When Christians start leaving off the sanctuary and just coming to serve, there's a big problem coming if it's not there already. And the only defense we have for that is the ministry of the word. This is our counseling session. This is our council room for all of us. And we want, if we can get more workers in each ministry, that means more rest for all the workers because the rotation broadens. And it is, you don't get sentenced to a ministry. You don't come to the house of God to just serve. You come to be fed, to sit, to meditate, to be available to God. And this is His doing. And we're just trying to map it out. From the scriptures. To do this, you, at least speaking for myself, you have to block out tradition. You just block out what everybody else is doing, and you start from the beginning. And if they're doing it too, or if you can pick something up from them that works, then go grab it. But it, just filter out stuff that, well, everybody does it that way, not grounds for acceptance. Well, you'll make enemies that way, but it'd be worth it. Broomp. Okay, we'll speed this up. Verse 26 and 27, again, speaks of critical ministry and the housing to get those who serve in Jerusalem close to the temple, and that would be to the benefit of the people. All of this was abused at some point. So it always comes down to what that generation is going to do. Verse 28, now some of them were in charge of the serving vessels, for they brought them in and took them out by count. And some of them, verse 29, were appointed over the furnishings and over all the implements of the sanctuary and over the fine flour, the wine, the oil, the incense, the spices. And some of the sons of the priests made ointment of the spices. So again, the Levites could do a lot of the support work and the support ministry. It's critical work. Everybody can't be a chief. The priests, they were the ones that made the spices. And again, not a peep, not about why do you get to do it. Verse 33. Well, let's see. Or we can just, you can read it later and make it just a note. A general policy was that the Levitical classes would live in the capital city so that they could concentrate on ministry. Well, I'll take it. Verse 33. I gobbled up time fumbling like that. But recovery. These are the singers, heads of the fathers' houses of the Levites who lodged in the chambers and who were free from other duties, for they were employed in that work day and night. And these heads of the fathers' houses of the Levites were heads throughout the generations. They dwelt at Jerusalem. And so they were dedicated, and they had plenty of work to keep them busy. Now we come to verse 39. Ner begot Kish. Kish begot Saul. Saul begot Jonathan. So he's returning now to the Benjamites, to King Saul's family, because he's going to close it up. Verse 1 of 1 Chronicles 10. Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. Then, verse 2, the Philistines followed hard after Saul and his sons, and the Philistines killed Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, Saul's sons. And so, again, there was a fourth son, Ishbosheth, or Ishbaal. He's not mentioned. He just wasn't there for whatever reason. Maybe he's too young. Maybe he just had a headache that day. Verse 3, the battle became fierce against Saul. The archers hit him, and he was wounded by archers. Well, back to that thought. Could have been. Maybe they said, well, we can't have the entire dynasty up on the hill. And we all get killed. There's no one left. So maybe they designated him the survivor. And if we don't come back, then you're the king. And that is largely what happened. It just didn't work. Verse 3, the battle became fierce against Saul. The archers hit him, and he was wounded by the archers, those long-distance killers. Joseph, metaphorically, was sought by the archers. His father said, the archers have sorely sought you. They tried to kill you from a distance, from all angles. They failed because Joseph's bow, his bow was held by the mighty hand of God. Saul would have enjoyed that blessing too had he adhered to Yahweh, but he did not. He's one character in Scripture where if I see him in heaven, I'll be surprised and pleased. And if I don't see him, I won't be surprised. He's such a mess. How can you make an excuse for him? Just because God chose him to be king did not guarantee him entrance into heaven any more than when Judas was chosen to be one of the apostles. That didn't guarantee his way into heaven. And he is called a son of perdition, and he is in hell. Verse 4, Then Saul said to his armor-bearer, "Draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised men come and abuse me." But his armor-bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. Therefore Saul took a sword and fell on it. Well, these men, they were fighting for their lives together. And to radically shift that and say, "Okay, now kill me." How do you do that? And the armor bearer, plus because it was Saul, he was a commanding figure. I always think of Charles de Gaulle. If you ever can look at footage of Charles de Gaulle, he looks like what Saul might have been as far as persona, very tall, above everybody else, and arrogant. But anyway, rather than fall into the hands of the Philistines and be tortured to death, he opted to extinguish his life. But Saul long ago ended his spiritual life. It really never was in there. He had one flash of it in the early days. It's not Saul amongst the prophets, but that was really it. Verse 5, then his armor-bearer saw that Saul was dead. He also fell on his sword and died. We know that they were finished off by an Amalekite. And the Philistines, after the battle, after they just, blanketed the top of Mount Gilboa with arrows, sun's going down, tomorrow morning we'll all go up and we'll pillage the bodies. That's what they did. But the Amalekite gets up there before them, and Saul is still living according to the Amalekite, and he finishes him off. You can see Mount Gilboa. You go to Israel, it just sticks out like a sore thumb, and you just say, well, that was a scene of a turning point in Israel's history, the end of the dynasty of Saul and the beginning of, the end of the reign of Saul was much of a dynasty and the beginning of the Davidic dynasty. Verse 6, so Saul and his three sons died, and all his house died together. I think that last line, "all his house died together," has to do with their spirit. And they were just no longer a force after that, because they all did not die. Again, he had sons, one son that survived at least. But what an ignominious ending. What a shameful ending. Opportunity does not guarantee success. It should excite us to success, but it doesn't guarantee it. You still have to go out and do it. And if the opportunity is given by the Lord, you have every reason to succeed. But problem is that we're either not content with what the Lord has given us, and we do God, then God hears peeps out of us, and we change our ways, potentially, and we can become a problem and forfeit it, as did Saul. He is the poster boy for "don't do this. Do not serve God this way." Verse 7, and when all the men of Israel who were in the valley saw that they fled, and that Saul and his sons were dead, they forsook their cities and fled. Then the Philistines came and dwelt in them. So it happened that next day when the Philistines came to strip the slain that they found Saul and his sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. Verse 9, and they stripped him and took his head and his armor, and sent word throughout the land of the Philistines to proclaim the news in the temple of their idols and among their people. Careful that he makes sure he says they're idols, they're not gods. Verse 10, and they put his armor in the temple of their gods and fastened his head in the temple of Dagon. Well, the Philistines seem to have always celebrated their victories by taking trophies to the house of Dagon. And you might remember that Samson, he brought the house down. They on the Philistines at the house at the temple of Dagon, and it collapsed. When the ark was captured by the Philistines, they took it. That's when Hophni and Phinehas were killed, and Ichabod was named. They took the ark to the temple of Dagon, and of course his head and his hands toppled over, and there were indications that there's something going on here that's outside of human engineering. And so that just the historical part. Verse 11, and when all Jabesh-Gilead heard all that the Philistines had done to Saul, All the valiant men arose and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons, and they brought them to Jabesh and buried their bones under a tamarisk tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days. 10 miles east from Beth Shan, where they took the body of Saul, is Jabesh Gilead. We know also from Samuel's account, they marched through the night to get there to take the bodies of Saul and his sons back just across the Jordan into the land of Gilead and give them a burial. No other city in all Israel raised a finger to take away the shame of the desecration on the body of Saul and the princes of Israel. But the men of Jabesh Gilead remembered the kindness that Saul had shown them many years ago, decades ago. They never forgot. And in gratitude, they did this deed. There was a time their city was surrounded by those of Ammon, and the terms were, "We'll let you live if we get to pluck out your right eye." Well, those are terms you want to think about. And so they said, "Well, let's send to Saul. He's the new king, and see if he'll come and help us." And Saul came and helped them and delivered them. And they never forgot. And they risked their lives for the dead bodies, the mutilated bodies of Saul and his sons. And they pulled it off to their honor. And that's what the writer, he's saying to this nation. You want to build the faith of the nation? Well, you're going to have to do things like this. You're going to have this kind of stuff in you. And it's good that he writes this down. Verse 13, "So Saul died for his unfaithfulness, which he had committed against Yahweh. But he did not keep the word of Yahweh, and also because he consulted a medium for guidance, a witch, you could say, a spiritist." Saul's death was not by his own hand, but it was his own fault. And finalized by the hand of God. God brought these circumstances to this. Samuel told him, "You'll be with me tomorrow in the underworld, not necessarily on the same side." And God let Saul take the road that led him to death. God opened the road that led to life, and Saul opted not to take that route. And so this verse here, it enforces the prohibition against dialogue with the dead. That's what Saul did. He sought a medium. "I don't want God. I want some other energy from the universe somewhere to help me out." In the end, that's what he was saying. He knew what God was going to say, and he didn't want to hear it. He insists that it was not God's will, nor will it be excused. It was not God's will that he go to a witch. It was not God's will that he be killed on Mount Gilboa. But because it could not be excused, that is what became God's will. There is an adjustable will. There's a fixed will of God, a perfect will, and then there is that adjustable will of God that will bend and curve to some degree on some things. It's the permissive will of God, it's called. Verse 14, "But he did not inquire of Yahweh, therefore he killed him and turned the kingdom over to David, the son of Jesse." This is a topical message. These are so powerful verses. You verse by verse study, you can't really take the time to open them up. But is there a more blunt statement in all Scripture? God killed him, just like that. And who would dare object? Who would say, "Who do you think you are?" Because the answer is easy. I'm God. It's prerogative of God. "He turned the kingdom over to David, the son of Jesse." Now the Davidic dynasty begins, and we get away from the introduction, and we will start King David. But we read in 1 Samuel, verse 15, "So Samuel said to him, 'Yahweh has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to a neighbor of yours who is better than you.'" Oh, man, may God never say anything like that about me. May he never say, "I'm going to take what was for you and give it to someone else because they're better than you." And that is why it is in the Bible, so we can read it and be warned and not terrorized by it. That's not necessary. We're built in such a way we have enough to look at that and say, I'm not going there. I'm not going to do that. I may stumble. I may even trip and fall. But I will not slither. And that's what Saul did. His refusal to seek God went deeper than the surface. It went under rocks. And he was judged for it. Let's pray. Our righteous Father in heaven, Lord, may we take heed to your word, all of it, every bit of it. And whatever stood out to us tonight, may we make use of it to your glory. And may you get us all home safely tonight, we ask you. In Jesus' name, amen.